In contrast to other ethnic groups or immigrants, Boston blacks did not consider themselves a minority group. The Irish were a minority group, the Jews, the Italians, the Greeks, who were barred from belonging by old country memories, accents, and mores. The black Brahmins felt that they had nothing in common except a facial resemblance. Though they scorned the Jew, they were secretly pleased when they could pass for one. Though they were contemptuous of Latins, they were proud when they looked European. That's a passage from the 1948 novel The Living is Easy by Harlem Renaissance author Dorothy West. If Dorothy West was an important African-American novelist, short story writer, and journalist, why have so few people heard of her? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Born in 1907 in Boston, Dorothy West moved to New York at a time when it was filled with possibilities for African-American artists. She was called The Kid by Langston Hughes, and she published works by Richard Wright and Ralph Ellison in the magazines she edited. Her first novel, The Living is Easy, went out of print for a while, but a later novel called The Wedding, written when she was 85 years old, was turned into a TV miniseries by Oprah. What is most important to know about the 91 years of Dorothy West? What does her biography tell us about race, class, and gender? Joining us is Shireen Sherard Johnson, professor of English at the UW-Madison, and the author of Dorothy West's Paradise, a biography of class and color, published by Rutgers University Press in 2012.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Where to begin? Let's, if we can, start with some terms and maybe not try to put too fine a point on it, but when we hear about the Harlem Renaissance, does that literally mean a rebirth?
Well, and you know, this is an area of some critical disagreement. I think we think of it as an era of artistic activism, a kind of explosion of literary and artistic output that were connected to an ideology of uplift. So the sense that art could affect political change. This had happened before in the long history of African American literature in this country. In the 1890s was another era that people have begun to think about as a similar kind of explosion. So Renaissance could be referring, I think, in many ways to coming back to that period or even an earlier period during which slave narratives were being published. So one could say there are many different Renaissances, you know, and of course, not just the Harlem one, but the one we think of more generally. But I do feel like the writers themselves felt like they were in a very special time. And that's part of why that term has adhered and maintained. And people use it now even to talk about things that have nothing to do with art, in fact.
Would Dorothy West's family, early years of the 20th century, have been aware of this burgeoning of art in Harlem? I mean, she seems to have come to it at such an early age.
Right. She comes to it. It's an interesting story. An aunt of hers brings home a journal that was associated with the Renaissance. There were several journals, The Messenger, The Crisis, Opportunity. And she tells a story of looking in the journal and seeing that there was literally this new Renaissance. Some people refer to it as the New Negro Renaissance, the New Negro Movement, that there were artists and writers and also musicians in Harlem, and that there were these editorial prizes for short fiction. And she'd been writing since she was very young, and it had been part of a local writers group. And it was through submitting her short story, The Typewriter, to this journal and winning. Actually, she ended up sharing the prize with Zora Neale Hurston, much to Hurston's ire.
But a great figure in her own right.
Exactly. This is what brought Dorothy and, in fact, her cousin Helene to Harlem. And they were very young. They came for the awards dinner and then later decided to move there. And so it had been going on, but her family may not, I mean, being in Boston, the kind of regionalism, they may not have known about it in depth, but at least they knew enough to, for instance, support a journal, right? At least an aunt had that.
And what was significant about Dorothy West's childhood before she got to New York? Mm-hmm. How privileged was her upbringing compared to that of other African-Americans at the time?
Well, she's from a unique family in that her father was an entrepreneur. He's referred to as the Black Banana King of Boston. So he was a local fruit seller who imported, among other things, bananas. And so as an entrepreneur, that did give them some level of stability. But I want to qualify that and just say some level, because when one is beholden to the demands of the market, it can fluctuate. And her parents, finally, you know, did separate. And her mother was pretty much the matriarch of the home at that point. And so there's a sense that Dorothy's family, we think of them as being part of certainly a middle class group that was very small, and so we think of it as being elite, but they really went back and forth. In fact, one of her descendants describes it as, you know, several of them kind of pooling their resources in order to live better than they actually could have, based on what would be considered, you know, say, middle class during the time. And I think that's something that in doing this work, trying to understand the shifting nature of class in the African American community was such that you couldn't really equivocate it with what we would think of as middle class.
I think you call
groups.
It genteel poor
yes.
at one point in your book.
Yeah, I think that was a good way of thinking about it. So she was sort of inside and outside, certainly moved in those elite circles, but also did struggle and had a sense of what it was like to be working as well.
You write about how preoccupied she seems to be in her writing by skin color, beauty, appearance, the sort of gradations and shades of different you know, and it seems as if it's something that came out of her background as well. You include a quote where she said to her mother, "You wouldn't give me your beauty and you wouldn't give me my father's blue eyes." Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's something that always struck me. It comes out of interview when West did an interview with the Black Women's Oral History Project that's housed at Harvard with Jenny Guinier. And it always struck me as such a funny statement to make. And even West herself realizes that it was somehow unfair to put that at her mother's feet. But she certainly did grow up, I think, being an only child, the daughter of a woman who was thought to be a great beauty in her own right, and yet didn't resemble her daughter. I think that created a bit of a psychological disjunction in terms of understanding oneself as beautiful. I think like many girls, it meant that she put a lot into her creativity and into her intellect. And yet at the same time, despite her mother's beauty, she did not think of her mother as being an intellectual. In fact, I think it was her mother who was very encouraging of many of her artistic and scholarly endeavors. One of the things in terms of doing research on this, the question comes up, well, you know, was she really that different from her family members? And if you look at family pictures, you see that people do look many different ways, but that doesn't necessarily translate into how a child feels growing up. And I think the point is that she felt she looked different, that people didn't associate her with her mother, and that it was the skin color did seem to make a difference in terms of how she perceived herself being treated, and thus made her, I think, more sensitive to those gradations in others.
So this story, this groundbreaking story of hers, The Typewriter, that she wrote when she was, what, 17?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Given what you've been telling us so far, what's her point of view in the story?
Well, the point of view in The Typewriter tells a story of a hardworking man who's, you know, based a little bit on her father, although this man was more working class, right? Her father was not, in the sense that he actually was an entrepreneur and owned his own business, but a man who's a janitor and had higher aspirations in terms of what he would have hoped he could have done when he first moved from the South. So it really is a story, a migration story, and he has some longing for things. That there's several moments in the book where he collects experiences from the South that he feels that he's lost.
Oh, sure. Yeah, the cornbread, steaming cornbread,
right.
And the little things like that. And this is taking place on a cold day. And is it set in Boston?
Yes, it is. I think it's there aren't a lot of cues, and sometimes people will associate it with Harlem, but I think it is, it's supposed to. But I think it also does work as a northeastern city that which people have come from the South with these ideas of things being different, and then finding out that there are similar circumstances that prevent the kind of advancement that you would hope. And so through his daughter's typewriting lessons and dictating to her letters, he imagines himself as a businessman, that what one he would have seen himself becoming.
He's swinging deals with J.P. Morgan, and he actually then dictates these return letters from J.P. Morgan as becomes a bigger and bigger fantasy.
Yeah, I believe the name of it, I think it's J. Lucius Jones that he takes on.
Yeah,
it's
right.
A similar
yes.
name. And, right, and then is crushed, in fact, when this fantasy that he's been participating in, and it's not really clear that the daughter knows what's going on. Mm-hmm. She's using this more as practice. But in fact, it's practice for her to actually have a higher level job, right? She's going to use this in order to catapult herself into a job that would exceed what her father
can
do.
To learn to take dictation.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say characterizes her voice that makes it different from anybody else's if you're looking at something like the typewriter.
You know, there's this slight, I think the slight satirical edge that she brings to it. And even in those scenes where the narrator is reminiscing about cornbread, it's almost like a slight caricature that comes out. And that's, I think, one thing that makes West writing distinctive is that, you know, you can read it and you definitely get the sense of the people that she's writing about, but she's often a little bit tongue-in-cheek. And she sometimes will put herself into it. In several of her short stories, there are characters that are based on versions of herself. Family members often come into play with a difference. But I really feel like what you hear is that astute social commentary with just a little bit of a self-critique that's connected to it.
What else is important to know about her childhood in terms of her models as a reader? Because presuming that she wrote stories starting very early on, she must have been an avid reader. You mentioned in your book Edith Wharton as one model, one person that she draws from. Where else did she draw inspiration from?
Well, she liked Dostoevsky and she liked Chekhov. I mean, I think especially as a short story writer, these were authors who she tried to emulate, and especially their commentary on class distinctions and divisions. Certainly Edith Wharton, they both wrote novels of manners, and that is a form that she would use in the short stories, but both employ to some extent in both The Living Is Easy and her last novel, The Wedding. It would be wonderful to cite earlier African-American writers that she cited as influences, but she, in fact, does not. Although in her community, she was surrounded by some early figures like Pauline Hopkins, who's also from the Boston area, and certainly must have been present in some way, you know, in her early life, even if it's just by proximity. So I feel like there were some. She was part of what they called the Saturday Evening Quill Club, which was a writer's group. And through there, and her sister, cousin, Helene Johnson, was also part of that as well. And so they were able to create circles of exchange, not always with fiction. But in terms of who she would say, she definitely cites, again, Dostoevsky as one of her models.
So 1924, 1925, she's a 17-year-old in Harlem. How does she fare? And how do the other writers there treat the kid, as they call it?
Well, by the time they come for this awards dinner, and then they later decide to move there. And at first, they're staying at the YMCA, which many people, YWCA, which several young people would have stayed there when they came to Harlem. But eventually, she and her cousin, they come together, and they're often referred to as the cousins. And they're really received, I think, with a sense of excitement, because I feel like during this period, and many critics of the era who are writing during this time, like Wallace Thurman and others, are beginning to critique what's going on in the artistic community. They're already beginning to see the excitement around the literary production, the quality of it ebb. And so I feel like she and her cousin Helene are really seen as bringing a breath of fresh air into Harlem, and are seen as people who could maybe hopefully reinvigorate the movement. So I don't think they're treated as, I think they're really protected and actually very well received.
And how political was she at this point, and how political was her family? In other words, were they active in terms of anything that we would consider civil rights?
No, I don't. Her family was not. Dorothy West's political activism, I think it's tricky. It changes over the course of her life. Certainly, she tries to do it through her writing. But what she's advocating, it's hard to claim it as being radical or leftist, although she certainly does go to this. She ends up going on this Russia trip in 1932 with several people who are, in fact, sort of card-carrying members of the Communist Party.
Starts to sound like a Richard Wright situation.
Exactly. But she has real disagreements with them, and she ultimately, even after her time in Russia, still feels as if racial inequalities are the primary goal in terms of civil rights activism, that she has a hard time believing in this idea of a kind of interracial, cross-interclass solidarity, partly, I think, because she intuits that these class divisions are very pernicious, and it's hard to see them. It's hard to really overturn them. And so I think for her, that's where her primary goal lies. And so it makes her reluctant to claim herself as a Marxist, although she, again, has this real class critique. Living Is Easy comes very close to being an anti-capitalist novel, except there are other moments when she's clearly very proud of what the characters have been able to achieve given the discrimination of the time, right? And I think that's part of the complexity in her work, that on one hand you get this critique, on the other you get this admiration, right? And that's present in, from her early work, I think, all the way through. So, you know, she, I think Langston Hughes describes some of the people in the circle as sort of cloaking themselves in communist accessories. Mm-hmm, so they're calling each other comrade.
Right.
But, you know, are they, it's not to the level of Richard Wright's or even Ellison's later affiliations. And many of them also disavowed those ties later on in the period.
At what point does she start getting into then writing novels such as you know, Living is Easy? I mean, if she makes her breakthrough as a short story writer, but how long does it take her then to get into the longer forms?
So it takes her some time, right? I think by the time The Living is Easy is published in 1948, the Harlem Renaissance is long over. Right? She's left Harlem and is pretty much settled, decided to settle in Martha's Vineyard at that point, back in her family's home in Oak Bluffs. And so at the she in some ways is outside those literary circles at that time, by the time she's able to publish the first novel. So it's hard to claim it as a Harlem Renaissance novel unless you look at the kind of continuity that appear in the short stories and the fact that she does several short stories that are in some way setups for what will later appear in the novel.
And we'll look at her novel, The Living is Easy, when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I don't know which is more interesting, fiction or life. That's a comment by Dorothy West, Harlem Renaissance author. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Shireen Sherard Johnson, and we are talking about Dorothy West. Before we get to her first novel, The Living is Easy, which you say you wouldn't be doing your book about her if she hadn't written that novel. That's, you know, one of the reasons you're writing the book. But before we get to that, could you talk a little bit about the Russia trip and also about her acquaintance with Langston Hughes? You include a wonderful photograph of Langston Hughes and Dorothy West together. Tell us about the two of them and also what difference that trip made in her view of the world.
Right. The Russia trip was really the trip that she feels really helped her commit to herself as a writer. It was rather than be a political pilgrimage, it was more of a spiritual and creative pilgrimage, one where she explored different parts of herself. One of the things about Dorothy West is that we don't know a lot about her adolescence or her interior life. She was interviewed many times, but she was very good at not giving away very much. But during that period she was in Russia, the letters that she wrote during those times are a real treasure trove towards gaining insight into what made her tick as a person. Her relationship with Langston Hughes is one of much controversy. His biographers, as well as those who've worked on West, have suggested further intimacy, and she certainly suggested in her own letters and writes love letters to Hughes, hoping to form a relationship. Perhaps a marriage, perhaps produce children. Some of my favorite letters that she wrote to her mother come from this period. At the same time, there's a sense that she is also performing something, maybe something that's expected, because it was also during this period that she carried on a relationship with Mildred Jones, who was her roommate during the time. And Mildred Jones was also carrying on a relationship with a Russian and several who proposed to her during the time. So you got a sense of these intersecting triangles that appeared during this period. So on one hand, the group that goes on this Russia trip, many of them who were not necessarily card-carrying communists, Louise Thompson, whose memoir I rely upon quite a bit to talk about the female experience of this trip, because a lot of what we know about the Russia trip comes from Claude McKay's work on what he called the magic pilgrimage and Langston Hughes's memoir, I Wonder as I Wander. But I wanted to see if I could unearth other experiences, other voices talking about this trip. And so Louise Thompson's papers were very helpful there, as well as Dorothy West letters. And so you get the sense that, yes, there were inspirational moments of political affiliation, but much more the trip was about a kind of spiritual journey, especially for Dorothy West. And she writes about it in that way. She talks about being a place she wants to return to because she has this connection with the Russian soil and her soul. You know, this is the language that she uses to describe the trip. It's also the trip where she hoped that perhaps she and Langston would, again, cement their relationship. And I can read a section from one of the letters that she wrote during that period. "Lang, I love you. Must we be sensible about money? I have no dowry. I'm sure you have very little in the bank. Does it matter? I shall write very much. You will write very much. You have a fine, fearless brain to give a baby. I have an unusually strong body. That's sufficient heritage." So within her
not
language...
Not exactly subtle, is it?
No, it's not, it's not subtle at
but
all.
But that's a letter to him or to her mother?
This is so this one is a letter to Langston.
Yeah.
And we have no... we don't have what his response would be. His biographer, Arnold Rampersad, suggests that this was never consummated. I incline to agree with him. And even in the letter, at the end of the letter, she writes as a postscript, "Lang, I've not thought of this. After all, I may have been fooled. Perhaps your feelings don't coincide with mine. If so, let me forever think you never received this letter, and let me go on cherishing my lost love." So there's a sense to me that there has been some lingering doubt all along about the nature of their friendship. I think it was a very deep friendship, and even after the Russia trip, when she returns to start the Challenge magazine, which is really, we think of that as the last journal of the Harlem Renaissance. She and Langston are corresponding about the journal, and she brings up Russia many times, but again, not in this romantic context again. There's also some sense in letters to her mother that her father dies while she's in Russia. And so part of what could be driving this what I'd say a more heteronormative urge towards marriage and children for someone who ultimately would never marry and would later have a long-term relationship with Marion Minas, who was her co-editor of The Challenge, was perhaps just thinking about, you know, the loss of her father and what mm-hmm. and passing on a different kind of legacy. Ultimately, the legacy she chooses to pass on is through writing. I think after the Russia trip, she really commits herself to writing. Even though she's a little bit of hesitancy when she's editing the journal, you think maybe she's going to fall back and go behind the scenes. She still contributes a lot to her own journal. And that's one thing you see in The Challenge. She writes under a pseudonym, actually a couple. One of them is Mary Christopher that she uses for the Russia pieces. And so she's already, again, beginning to write fiction again. And then that later comes to coalescence in what will be her seminal novel, The Living is Easy.
Was music important to her the way it was to Langston Hughes? If you think of the Weary Blues and the way Langston Hughes wove in jazz and rhythm and so on, was for Dorothy West, was she fully aware of the musical tradition?
You know, that's something that I don't see so much in her writings. In her last novel, In the Wedding, she has a character who's a musician. And there she does write about jazz. In fact, it's one of he's actually white, right? European-American mm-hmm. character who's a jazz musician. And there I feel like she does seem to be drawing on that tradition or trying to understand what that musical tradition meant to various people. But in her earlier works, mm-hmm. music isn't something, that culture doesn't seem to come into play.
But the title, The Living is Easy, sounds as if it comes from Porgy and Bess.
It does. And so, and I think that comes from her experiences acting. She was, and it's interesting, the Russia trip, the whole purpose of the Russia trip in 1932 was that they were going to film a film that was going to be called Black and White. And so they bring these individuals over, but very few of them had any acting experience. But Dorothy was one of the few who did, because she had been in Porgy and Bess in London. She'd been a kind of what they call an extra numerary, a kind of extra in that. And some of her circle did include people who were active, like Blanche White. And many of these were from the Oak Bluff circle, or women she'd known in Boston and in Martha's Vineyard. And so she did, you know, circle that the theater world. And so, right, even though she has a different story for the title, the title The Living is Easy certainly has those connections.
And
but
so,
that's a different tradition of musical tradition, not necessarily blues and the jazz in the same way we think of.
So if we look at the early piece, The Typewriter, and then this later piece from 1948, a novel, mm-hmm. versus the short story, The Living is Easy, how is her thinking developing? I mean, is Living is Easy really kind of an outgrowth of some of the same ideas that we see in the earlier stories, or is she breaking, what kind of new ground is she breaking?
in The Living Is Easy. I think that she's combining a lot of genres in The Living Is Easy. One is just the kind of Bildungsroman, right? And she's very focused on this young girl protagonist, although she doesn't quite come of age to the end. It almost gets ended with Judy, who's the main protagonist of it, but also her mother, Cleo, who threatens to, and very much does take over the text because she becomes such an interesting and complex heroine. So on one hand, she's bringing those aspects, these texts where she's written in the voice of a child or had a child as an important character in her book. This isn't the first time Judy appears in different stories, but this is where she comes fully formed. So that mother-daughter aspect that's been present in short stories is there. The class consciousness that she's reworked through works like The Typewriter is there. But also the relationships that she's explored in some of the other Harlem stories as well, where husbands and wives often marry for the wrong reasons, and usually, in her mind, social climbing reasons, as opposed to, say, true love or color. And color and class run alongside each other here. And so I feel like you see her issues with relationships that she's trying to work out appear in The Living Is Easy. Lots of models for dysfunctional relationships, not just the main one with the mother and father are there. Certainly, I do feel like you can connect what she's thinking about in The Typewriter and her experiences, at least looking at how one might hope to redefine or restructure society in a way that would be where class definitions would be less defined. You see that present in terms of her critique of capitalism and property and the kinds of investments that people put into material items and material gain.
Yeah, we see that in The Typewriter too, in a sort of an ironic, almost whimsical way, you know, again, with the imagined correspondence, you know, with important business people. Mm-hmm. And then what you said about the reasons for people that people marry, kind of interesting. The Typewriter too. There's an odd little bit in there. The reason the reason that the main character marries his wife is implied to be that he gets these great leftovers from a chef and he needs somebody to share them with. I mean, that was a new one.
Right, yeah, Disney, yeah. And I think there are May-December weddings that kind of take place, and that's sort of what's suggested is behind the marriage and The Living Is Easy as well. I feel like she just has a real distrust of marriage as an institution, especially as a heteronormative institution. At the same time, she sees it as the I also feel like there is a sense that she sees it as the one way to consolidate a middle class existence in the Black community. So she also writes about it again and again. In some ways, I don't want to suggest that advocating it, but there's this tension there between seeing it as flawed in many ways, but then also seeing it as critical towards acquiring a kind of stability that will stabilize a class existence instead of the precariousness which plagues many of the characters.
You quote a reviewer who referred to Cleo, the mother, as a yellow Scarlett O'Hara. Can you talk about that?
Right. Well, Cleo, you know, she's so interesting. She's referred to as being amoral, an anti-heroine, a social climber, very much similar to some of Edith Wharton's social climbers, and both in The House of Mirth, but also The Custom of the Country. A lot of people think that she's similar to Undine Spragg. You know, she is one of those women that I feel like everybody knows and they kind of love to hate. You know, she's beautiful. She can perform a kind of femininity that everybody wants to follow. And yet at the same time, it's an act. It's a performance.
And it's manipulation.
Yeah, exactly. So she in some ways is able to kind of out-Boston the Bostonians or out-Brahmin the Black Brahmins, even though she's from South Carolina. Right, so there's she doesn't actually have the birthright, right? And this is part of what makes her so hungry and so determined to have this for herself, for her sisters, for her husband. And yet it's very much out of step with the real things that are important in life. And even Cleo has moments of self-reflection on her own. Sometimes there are these moments where she seems to stop or pause and reflect on what she's doing. But then she tends to go ahead with it. Anyway, with disastrous results, right, for her family and for many of the people in her circle, even when she seems to or hopes she has their best interest at heart. So she systematically destroys all of her sister's marriages. This is one of the things that happens over.
The subtitle of your book, A Biography of Class and Color, what does the novel The Living Is Easy have to say about color?
Well, Cleo is very light-skinned, as are her sisters, but the daughter looks like the father. So the daughter is dark-skinned, as is the father. So there is this disjunction between the daughter that Cleo hopes to model after her own likeness, but with a difference, right? This is the daughter who will be actually born in Boston. So she really has a sense that this daughter can even go places that she couldn't go. And the disappointment is that the daughter turns out to resemble not just her father, but resemble people she associates more with the working class, more newly immigrated class of people in Boston. And so part of the tension between mother and daughter comes from that. And yet Judy is in some ways, she's very intelligent. She's probably one of the sweeter characters of the text. And she's through us that we're able to witness her mother's downfall. And even her cousins adore her. And the cousins are also all lighter skin. There's a point in the book where one of the characters observes that they just assumed that Cleo and her sisters were the cream of the South simply because of how they looked. So in some ways they're being given a class status that has nothing to do with their birth or their money, but has everything to do with just how well they're able to perform it, which I think does erode our notions of inheritance and entitlement. If these things can be performed, then nothing is inherited or intrinsic in a way. And that's part of a commentary that I think West does bring to it. At the same time, not just in The Living is Easy, but in other novels as well, it's hard to get around the fact that so many of her heroines are light-skinned. This is not just West. Many of the authors from the Harlem Renaissance, this was also the case, partly because characters who were either mixed race or ambiguously raced were often mediating vehicles to discuss the problems of Jim Crow and to point and to illustrate that racial distinctions had no basis in reality, right? So part mm-hmm. of why writers use these figures was that they provided this kind of go-between. But when you're looking at within the African-American community, then it becomes a moment to think about ways in which internalized racism reproduces hierarchies within the culture, not just without.
Her family models seem to be heavy on sisters. Is that right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in fact, there's some disappointment going again back to the typewriter. There seems to be some disappointment that there was not a brother, a son born into the family.
Mm-hmm. Well, I imagine I'm thinking about a man who has a financial empire that he's maybe hoping to leave to his son, right? Ends up with one daughter and so has to pass on something else. I mean, I think that desire for siblings may have been there for her as an only child, but she had so many cousins. And also, I think the sisters are a reflection of her mother had a lot of siblings, and that both created a kind of matriarchal community, but also at different points, you know, possibly a burden, right, of having to always share, look after others as well. And so there's a tension there about the kind of communal feeling that having a large family brings to you, but also the possible disadvantages as well.
If I remember right from what you say in your book, the novel The Living is Easy went out of print until sort of brought back by the feminist press mm-hmm. later on. Mm-hmm. So kind of a two-part question, I guess, is one is why did it go out of print? And also, would you call Dorothy West a feminist?
Those are good questions. I think, you know, after it's the one thing that was nice about the Harlem Renaissance is when you have a movement to attach to something, then all of a sudden there are books that can be, you know, associated with that movement. I think like many authors during that time, there's a lack of interest. She also falls in that period, this sort of in between period that many scholars are now beginning to write on, the 1940s through the 60s,
right,
in terms of what's going on with that generation. There are people writing during mm-hmm. that time. Why are people not paying attention to it? And several of them are writing novels that are looking at class, looking at urban experience. Anne Petrie was one who wrote in that interim period. Gwendolyn Brooks, who's also a poet, wrote a novel. And I feel like those are very much novels that respond to or very much engage with some of the ideas in The Living is Easy. But the idea of a book, especially a book focusing on the Black middle class, had to find an audience. And I think that audience, it just drifted until it was reclaimed with with the discoveries of rediscovering Black feminist writers, or writers that would later be thought of as being part of the literary foremothers of the Black women's writing tradition. So when Zora Neale Hurston's book was brought back into print, and the others that came along with it, and the work that people did both interviewing people who were left, but also bringing books back out of print, it was natural, I think, to bring back The Living Is Easy. And I think, you know, there are moments in the text where Cleo, there's a text, a moment in the text when it's described where Cleo ruled over a pygmy kingdom, right? And it was insufficient, right? The house, the domicile was insufficient for her ambitions, right? So there is this sense that she would do more. And even the early parts of the text where it's more like Cleo's Bildungs Roman than it is Judy's, you see her hoping for a different kind of life, but at every turn, she's stymied. Her mother feels she's too wild in the South, so sends her north because she feels it's too dangerous for a girl to be as free and out there as she is. She ends up in the North, and then she's sort of preyed upon within the home she's staying in. She goes out off on her bicycle and runs smack into Bart Jensen, who then marries her, right? So there's this way in which I think that West is showing the limitations, right, that not just social limitations, but the actual geography of Boston seems to cave in on Cleo. And so all that's left for her is to rule this pygmy kingdom of children. And so it's almost as if there's an insufficient scope for the ambitions that she has. And so I think in that sense, reading her as a feminist makes it very appropriate that the Feminist Press republished it and has continued to publish it. So it's still in print now.
Well, her last novel was called The Wedding, and Oprah gets involved. We're going to talk about that and more about the life of Dorothy West when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Shireen Sherrard Johnson. And we're looking at still little known, relatively little known American writer named Dorothy West, who was part of the Harlem Renaissance in the 1920s and continued to write for many, many years after that, going through a big swath of American history. And her book, The Living Is Easy, came out in 1948. And too many years after that, then was kind of rediscovered as we get into the 60s. But she's still a relatively young woman in the 1960s when things politically are beginning to change so much. What does she have to say as an individual or as an author as we get into the 60s?
During that period, it was a complicated time to be a writer, I think, from the background that she had. At that period of time, she'd retreated to the island of Martha's Vineyard, and she was still writing. But the stories that she was writing during that time and hoping to publish were not finding the audience. Most mainstream publications who were looking for Black writing wanted writing that in her mind was more militant or overt or was about a more urban experience and about poverty. And she'd written stories like that. But she was beginning to write fiction that was where it was harder to decipher the race of the characters, or the characters were in middle class situations where they could be white or Black. She was writing stories that couldn't be easily put into one category. And so many of the letters that came back from editors of magazines like Scribner's were things like, you know, we already published our one Black writer for the year. Or, you know, this, if you could put more of that, you know, ethnic element into that. And I think this was very discouraging for her. And so for that reason, during this period, you don't see another novel like The Living Is Easy come out until the late 90s, even though she's working on several versions of it. And at different points, was maybe hoping to publish a novel during this period and had different publishing deals, and some of them fell apart. In her column that she wrote during this time, so one of the things that she does write is a column for the local paper, the Vineyard Gazette, and she writes a paper that starts off being referred to as Cottager's Corner and later develops a new name. And so some of the articles that she writes are during this period of 1960s and 70s, and she writes about Black power during this time, but she writes about it almost as if it's more of a style, an attitude. marriage. And in fact, some do offer that critique. And that's part of her critique, is that this is less about political change and maybe more about Afros. That's her suggestion. It's a bit more conservative of a suggestion. Now she's getting older as well. But the communities that she was concerned with, I think she felt were overlooked during this period for a more singular understanding of Black culture.
Is that column that she's writing for Martha's Vineyard Gazette, is that paying the rent, or has she inherited wealth? Or?
Oh, that's a good question. What is she doing to pay the rent? In that sense, I actually don't have an answer to that question. It's not my sense that the column could be doing that. So I imagine that there is a kind of pooling of resources in the house that she's living in. I mean, I don't know enough about the financial details at that point.
I'm just always impressed with writers who make the decision to keep writing things that are not necessarily making it in the market. They stick to their own style, even though they're not really making money off it. That intrigues me, because she must have known that she could have sold her books if she had chosen kind of a different voice.
Tell us about that whole Martha's Vineyard community.
So the community on Martha's Vineyard that Dorothy West was a part of is centered primarily in Oak Bluffs. And it's referred to as an African-American enclave. In other fictional and non-fictional accounts, some people actually use the term colony. Essentially, there have been a community of Black vacationers who have come to the island of Martha's Vineyard since the turn into the 20th century. We have evidence that even in the late 1890s, 1870s, that there were Black innkeepers who opened up hotels and boarding houses for vacationers, not just domestics who were working on the island. And it wasn't until later on in the century, with the opening of Shearer Cottage, that it then became a large number of population. And Shearer Cottage actually still exists in the Highlands area, not too far from Dorothy West's house. And so this community is a very old one. It's very established. It's hard not to associate it with elitism, because it is on Martha's Vineyard, and property values is what they cost now. But many people who vacation there are children of teachers and dentists and middle class folk who bought these homes a long time ago and have passed them down through generation. So while there is that notion of this being a place where now President Obama vacations and Spike Lee has a home there, there are also, and they are part of that community, but there are also multi-generational, intergenerational communities that have been coming to the island really since the early part of the 20th century.
That was part of Dorothy West's life.
And Dorothy West was part of that. She was really one of those early families, the West, as well as the family of visual artist Lois Mayo Jones. At one point, the two shared a house. I wish I couldn't find a picture of the house in the book. It was burned down in a fire. Lots of stories around that. But they owned a house together, and then eventually had different homes on the island. But they were one of those early families. So West was a part of that community, but she also chronicled it as it became more and more popular. And so a lot of what you see in her columns about the island has to do with the changing nature of that community. So on one hand, she wants to preserve what she finds special about it and maintain it as a respectable community. On the other hand, she also wants to record this history and for others to be encouraged to, if they are, I think the word is vacation-minded and island-oriented. It's one of the languages that she uses to describe the people who come to the island. If they are oriented in that way, she wants them to be able to come back and to continue this tradition as well.
She wants to preserve the ethnic origins of this community, or just the kind of the class structure of it?
Well, I think what many people, and not just Dorothy West, but in also talking to others who've been part of this kind of community that comes back again and again, both homeowners as well as people who rent, there's this real sense that it was a place where you could somehow step outside the sense of yourself as an oddity in American society, right? That instead of being how one in one's life, particularly if you work in the corporate world, where you might be a token or you might feel a sense of alienation, you could go to a place where everybody was in a similar position. And in that sense, it actually didn't matter. right? So it wasn't so much that it became an interracial paradise for people, but that it became a place where you could perhaps not think so strongly about race and racial divisions in the way that you might have to on the mainland. Mm-hmm. And that's what made it a special place, and I think what brought people back again. Again, it's not exclusively Black, obviously, and there are many people who visit Martha's Vineyard and have no idea. Mm-hmm. They might notice certain times of year there are more African Americans on the island than others, but many people, I think, might not have a sense that there has been that long tradition there.
And I suppose it's claiming the American dream, too, if you have a vacation place. If you have a sense of belonging in a community, that's, you know, it's a real symbol of the American dream. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what's important to know about her last novel, The Wedding, and why it got picked up by Oprah instead of The Living is Easy, which you say is her seminal work?
Right. Well, I think it has a lot to do with this notion of the American dream and what the vacation home represents. I think for Oprah, that was the novel that she wanted to showcase, this novel to maybe make people aware that there's this community of Black middle class, upper middle class folk who have vacation homes, who live like the Kennedys, that part of that tradition. And I think that's what she wanted to highlight. And I feel like that's why she went after The Wedding, as opposed to a novel that, you know, has quite a bit of... But not just the satirical elements, and because I think some of those elements are in The Wedding as well, but I think more of that anti-capitalist critique that's in The Living is Easy. It's not so present in The Wedding. But it is about intergenerational decisions, particularly marriage decisions, along both economic and color lines that lead to a kind of internal rot. So even within The Wedding, the novel, that is present. But I think for Oprah, both the complexities of the situation of the Black middle class as well as the space are part of why I think it was a book that she wanted to envision on the small screen.
Before we talk about Oprah's version and some of the changes that were made, can you give us a sense, kind of just a quick rundown of what The Wedding is about and what's important about it?
Right. So The Wedding focuses on a wedding that's going to happen between Shelby Coles, who is the daughter of an established vineyard family, although in the book it's not referred to in this. I mean, you know it's on Martha's Vineyard, but the language of the space that she's talking about in the novel is the Oval, whereas in actuality it would be the Highlands area. And so there's an uneasy... some geography is absolutely the same, and others are slightly different. But she's going to marry, or about to marry, a white man. So it's an interracial wedding that everyone is gathering to celebrate. And so it's a moment where, I guess, there's a kind of collision of cultures that's happening, and it provides the occasion for flashbacks and reflection on not just Shelby's parents' wedding, but again, the generational marriages that produced the Coles' wealth, as well as their peculiar family dynamic. Because in the novel, one of the ironies is that the Coles essentially look like white people. That Shelby is blonde, like her Confederate grandfather, and they are indistinguishable outside of this community that understands them through the space from European Americans. And so in some ways, reading the novel, well, what makes this an interracial novel? And for Graham, who's the white matriarch of the family, this is the marriage to her jazz musician fiance is going back to the European American roots. But for her parents, the fact that he's a jazz musician suggests the kind of illegitimacy in terms of the kind of wedding or the kind of marriage they would hope her to make. And in fact, they are not quite as critical as the other daughter. Their other daughter has also married outside of what the family's wishes were. She's married a very dark-skinned man, despite the fact that he's a professional. So neither daughter has fulfilled what either family hopes. And so it's an occasion for reflecting on those decisions over time. But the main event driving this is, will Shelby marry her white man or not? Will she be distracted away into a possible romance with a local African-American man who's on the island, who's sort of haunting the beginning? So again, it's kind of a love triangle. And in the television version, that love triangle is made more primary than some of the flashback reflections. There, in many ways, the novel is, the wedding is really just an occasion for thinking about this institution over time, whereas in the television version, it's much more central, right?
What about the decision to put Halle Berry in the role of Shelby?
Right. So, well, it's like in terms of, you know, she during the time was a very, was a hot actress, right? She was commodifiable in a good way. And I think that she brought a real name recognition to the wedding as opposed to using someone who would have resembled more closely the character. One of the things I write about in the book is that this aspect of Shelby, again, being indistinguishable from any other blonde, blue-eyed white woman, was part of the complexity of the novel itself that's removed when Halle Berry is put into that role, although some of it is carried and performed in other ways. So there are ways in which I do feel like the film tries to show some of that through slight gradations in terms of color casting, but it's not really able to do it because essentially it's almost as if it runs into a problem of how we see color and how we distinguish between class and color in our society. It's almost as if they had used, say, very light-skinned or ambiguously raced actors, society might not have read this as a film about black people. And so then they would have lost that aspect of it. Perhaps the aspect Oprah wanted to highlight the sense of black middle-class life on the vineyard. On the other hand, what is lost is, again, that the fact that this interracial marriage is far from the beginning of interracial interactions over the course of the century. And this is just part and parcel of what the American experience is about. And I think that aspect of it is lost in a more romantic version of interracial love across class lines. Because the real key issue in the wedding is if Shelby marries this jazz musician, will she just pass into whiteness, which is not a question that can be dealt with Halle Berry in that title role.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's a problem with television and with movies is maintaining the complexity of a novel or a play. And it's you know, also it's kind of ironic, I mean, because the whole marketing issue for Dorothy West had to do with, well, you don't fit into this category or that category. And that's kind of what she seems to be saying with the color spectrum in this book. Mm-hmm. But of course, the irony is that it can't be said very effectively in a medium like television.
Right. And I think that the television version does some of its own, you know, work as well. And it certainly probably most important work it did is it drew attention to Dorothy West, right?
Yeah.
Before she died. So I think in many ways, part of why we were able to get some of the interviews with her and why she was able to enjoy a bit of a Festschrift atmosphere before her passing had to do with the spotlight of Oprah. And though one of the great stories I heard from one of the people I interviewed was that Oprah was somehow surprised when she saw the actual site of the Oval. Which is described quite accurately in the novel. But again, it didn't quite fit what she was, the grandeur of what she was anticipating and what is ultimately portrayed in the television movie series. You know, little cottages in the deep woods with dirt paths connecting them didn't evoke the same idea of the vacation home.
Yeah,
which brings us back to Dorothy West's comment, I don't know which is more interesting, fiction or life, because it sounds as if the reality was not as interesting as what Oprah Winfrey wanted to make of it. You write near the end of your book, depending on the viewfinder we choose, West is either a closeted lesbian revolutionary or a color-struck grand dame of a bygone era. So which is it? Or both? All of the above?
I think both. And at the time, I mean, the question of whether or not she was in the closet, I mean, she had the relationship she had with Marion Minas was fairly well known to those in their circle. At the same time, I don't think she would have identified in that way because their relationships were not defined quite the way that they are now. When she was in Harlem, she was part of a group of people who were working against those definitions of heterosexuality. Some of them were going back and forth. Many of them were bisexual. And it's hard to say if that was the closet was certainly present, and they still did what was socially expected, which was you still got married, right? So a lot of them still married, despite the fact that they might have had same-sex relationships. So I think it's complicated to try and understand what her sexuality was over time. She certainly formed relationships with men as well, although she never married. And she still remained invested in marriage because she was always writing about it and thinking about it and often even talking about it. Even in her latter life, there are different figures surfaced as possible. Beau, certainly in some of her interviews with Deborah McDowell, she talked about Claude McKay and again, Langston Hughes as possible Beaus. But again, because their sexuality also was complex, right? It was hard to look at those those as legitimate husbands for Dorothy. And so it's hard to know whether or not that was, again, her kind of tongue-in-cheek, playful way of protecting her interior life. And I feel like her both that's done in her fiction as well as in her her own autobiographical writings as well. In terms of color, again, that's also a question that for me, even having worked on this project, remains somewhat elusive. There are certainly times when I felt she was very much critiquing colorism, and then there are other times when I felt she was upholding some of our ideas, especially in terms of beauty and beauty's association with what we might consider Eurocentric features, that's still present in her work, even as she's critiquing those as well. So I think she's a complicated person and a complicated artist.
But one worth looking at for sure. Our guest has been Shireen Sherrard Johnson. Thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.